Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for this first week of October. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today we'll be talking with Scott Breton. Scott is the founder of the Cedar Root Folk School. Scott is also a caring mentor and workshop leader to kids and adults interested in learning more about the world around them and building the story of their environment. A few months ago, we talked with Scott about bird voices and what can be learned from truly listening to what the birds are communicating to each other. Today, we'll be talking with Scott about wildlife tracking. Welcome, Scott. Glad to have you back on Nature Now.
Thanks for having me.
Before we talk to Scott, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, I suspect that most of you can identify the type of critter making this sound. But can you identify the species? And probably more interestingly, if you were to hear this sound on a walk in the woods at this time of year, what is it communicating? So now let's check on recent natural history observations around our region. Of course, fall is certainly here. The maples are changing colors. Fall mushrooms are coming up through the forest duff. The salmon are running and migrating birds are coming and going. Monica Fletcher shared her pleasure in watching the return of some of our winter residents that have been away for the summer, ruby-crowned kinglets, fox sparrows, and various ducks at Cotai Lagoon. Northern shovelers and American widgeons are increasing in numbers each day. Canada geese are gathering in greater numbers down from their summering place to join our resident honkers. Keep looking up for flyovers of geese, ducks, raptors, and maybe even a sandhill crane if you are close to the coast.
Visit a salmon stream near you to watch the wonder of returning salmon. Al Latham shared recent data from the North Olympic Salmon Coalition about the live counts of spawning salmon in Chimicum Creek, Snow, and Salmon Creeks. Summer chum salmon runs are peaking, and although no records are being set, the runs are strong in these restored creeks. Jefferson Land Trust Ilhi Preserve off Prospect Road is a great place to observe the returning salmon.
Boy, is it ever. Well, and just last week, the shaggy mane mushrooms are coming up almost overnight in my yard. Wendy Feltham reports seeing a host of interesting mushrooms during a recent hike along the lower Big Quilsing River. Stump puffballs, cauliflower fungus, and various members of the Boletus group, and several different shelf and bracket fungi.
Kathy Knobloch, an experienced birder here in town, reported watching a scrub jay bathing in a birdbath in her yard. A curious sighting, Kathy had never seen one around here before, and the scrub jay has deep blue wings, neck and tail, plus it lacks the black crest of the commonly observed Steller's jay.
I hadn't thought about it, but I don't think I've seen scrub jays here.
There was a report of one on Bainbridge Island last year, but okay. Supposedly they're moving north.
I guess. Well, let me reintroduce Scott Breton. I first met Scott during the Jefferson Land Trust Naturalist Training Course a few years ago. Scott was one of the leaders. And we talked earlier this year with Scott about bird language and what we can learn from really listening and understanding what we are hearing, and about the practice of using sit spots to increase our personal connection with the natural world and with ourselves. Today we are talking with Scott about wildlife tracking. So Scott, what first got you interested in wildlife tracking?
It was my journey in my 20s of becoming an astute naturalist and building a deeper relationship with the world around me. And I was lucky enough to have several influential mentors, Paul Resendez, Charles Worsham, Mark Elbrock, John Young, all of which shared their passion for wildlife tracking with me.
And here you are.
It caught on, yeah.
And you're sharing your passion with others. Yeah. That's wonderful. Well, before I go much further, just what is wildlife tracking or animal tracking? What does that mean?
Well, in its purest essence, it would just be pattern recognition of noticing the different nuances that animals or wildlife leave behind them as they move through our ecosystems, whether that's their tracks or whether it's their signs of where they laid down in a bed or a trail that they're leaving behind, or simply their influence on other animals.
So you try to put together essentially the story of their being in a habitat from what you see. Is that right?
Yeah. And in a lot of ways, you can learn more about an animal through their tracks than actually observing them, because there's subtleties that you can pick up in their tracks in terms of even the sex of the animal, or
really,
that you would have a hard time picking up if you were just observing, say, a coyote in your backyard.
Well, I think tracking as, well, sort of historically connected with hunting, especially for food, and with sort of, well, I don't know, I'll call them wilderness survival techniques. And I have to admit, I don't think many of us are likely to need those particular skills in our daily lives. So a couple of questions for you. Is animal tracking at all relevant in the modern era? And why should people be interested in tracking and learning how to track in these modern days?
There's a lot in that question. So let's unpack that one a little bit. I'd have to say that I don't necessarily believe that tracking was only used for hunting. And Mark Elbrock, a friend of mine and colleague, brought back a really great story when he was in South Africa last year. And he was with Kalahari Bushmen, and their amount of knowledge of tracks and signs of things that would be insignificant for livelihood, beetles and bird tracks and all sorts of, they knew their environment so well that when he handed them a field guide to their area, they had never seen a field guide before, and they proceeded to spend 2 hours going through each page and laughing in their own dialect and telling stories of when they saw that track or that animal or that insect or that bug. And
in that case, it's more about knowing the world you're living in.
Yeah, I think stretching our senses is inherent in how our operating system has been molded through evolution. And I don't know if we necessarily know what is directly related to our survival when we're paying attention. We are trying to pay attention indiscriminately to patterns around us.
Why is that important today?
Well, I'd say that it's important in a lot of ways. 1998 was the year that we went from mostly rural to mostly urban as a world population. And if we are what we pay attention to in some ways, then the fact that we're paying attention more to our human-created world rather than the quote-unquote natural world, I won't say that our human world isn't natural, but there is, as David Orr put it, there is an eyes-to-acre ratio that is diminishing in the rural landscape. And so with fewer people observing what's happening to the chorus frog in our backyard, the fewer people are accumulating patterns throughout the seasons of our populations in increase or in decline, and how can we nudge those numbers in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say ultimately, though, wildlife tracking leads you back around to yourself of what are the trails you're leaving behind and how's that impacting your community and the people around you. And if you can only watch wild animals for so long before you start realizing that they have to avoid ruts, well-worn paths, or they'll be eaten, and they have to continually pay attention. And I think both of those are lessons that behoove us to remember and realize that we still benefit from learning patterns on this planet.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, it sounds like keeping our consciousness alive of our entire habitat, animals, plants, humans, ourselves, and how that system works together.
Yes, and that we're continually tracking anyways. We have an instructor who shared a funny story out with kids a couple years back where a kid student picked up a little orange fleck off of the ground and turned to his friend, and his friend said, "Oh, that's a Cheeto." And he said, "No, it's a spicy hot Cheeto." So he could tell by the little green flecks in there.
Okay.
So it's a different kind of tracking, but our psyche is already primed to pay attention to patterns. It's just, what are the patterns we're paying attention to?
As you go about and you see those signs and you're observing patterns in the environment. Give me some more detail. What kind of images can you put together about the lives of wildlife? Or maybe tell me a story.
I guess how I would answer that would be that we're able to steer our conservation efforts better by learning wildlife tracking. We can look at individual parcels in forested landscapes are not all created equal, and there's some that are very beneficial and important as wildlife corridors and habitat, and others that aren't as significant. There are kind of deserts out there that are not as rich in biodiversity. And so tracking allows us to evaluate with a certain amount of finances to spend on conservation efforts. It helps dictate which ones, creates a matrix of importance. It also lets us know, are ecological restoration projects working? Are we able to see an increase in an abundance and a health and the strength of a diversity network of animals interacting together? It's very expensive to go out and actually hire biologists to observe or trap or radio collar animals. And so to have track and sign be a part of that toolkit, it's very, very useful for analyzing success of different projects.
So I can see it in sort of helpful in decision making as to what to do in conservation projects and then in evaluating the success of a particular decision. Can you tell things about the life of some of those creatures that you couldn't tell just by sighting?
Yeah, I was hired on a project about, well, I guess a decade ago now in Idaho with the Nez Perce tribe working on a wolf recovery project. And it was a very surreal experience because there was six biologists on the ground, all Caucasian, using ancient methods of track and sign while the Nez Perce were collecting data on flybys with radio telemetry. And it was just this really interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, really.
But we were all working together, and through measuring footprints and the gait of an animal, it's like having a fingerprint of a human that you can actually tell different individuals by. No two of those two measurements are the same. And so we were able to tease out different populations of packs of wolves that before that time were not known. And the Nez Perce were able to confirm for us in the next winter's flyover of this new pack that we recently discovered for them. And it was
so interesting.
Yeah, it was a great project.
Interesting. So that sort of is more than just sighting an animal. It's understanding something about the individuals and who they're.
Yeah, we never saw the pack, but we were able to decipher that there was two adults, two sub-adults, and a pup that was a new formed pack that was unknown before.
So you must have seen some really remarkable things in your tracking world. Share another story with me.
This is where sit-spot and bird language all collide into pattern recognition of animal tracking. And one that is really fun for me right now is I'm discovering that there are moon shadow trails of predators. And based on the trajectory of the moon, whether it's in the summer or the winter time, it's higher up in the winter and lower down in the summer, that these trails skirt the shadows of the tree lines and they'll move up and down because of that trajectory. And so it's kind of like the tides coming in and out throughout the year. And that one's new to me and it's really fun to watch. I knew there was a soft-footed trail. I didn't know if it was raccoon or coyote. I found out through bird language this spring that it was a coyote trail, and watching it move across this grassy meadow following the line that would conceal it during full moon nights has just been really fun for me.
How cool is that? Moon shadows.
Yeah.
Wow. Gives me little chills. So if a listener wanted to know more about wildlife tracking, how would someone learn more, and are there special places you'd go, or classes, or books, or how do you go about learning more?
Well, we've never been graced with more information on learning wildlife tracking, and in some ways, the dirt time that one puts in at their sit spot or just going out for hikes continually in the same areas, I wouldn't have learned the moon trail lesson if I was hiking new places all the time. This was constant observation, continual observation in one area. So I would say that's the greatest teacher is going out into the world
and
asking the questions yourself. Yeah. But I would say there's a couple very useful books. Mark Elbrock's book, Mammal Track and Sign, is great. He also has a bird track and sign book.
The name again?
Mark Elbrock.
Elbrock, okay. Yep.
And David Moskowitz has a Mammal of the Pacific Northwest book. That's a really great one. Cedar Root offers tracking intensive workshops, usually in the spring. And the Jefferson Land Trust, which I just learned about, is hosting another tracking workshop in the middle of this month. That's a great workshop. I've done that one before, and that is a local gem if you have time in your schedule to come join for that one. That's a great, great class.
So this is another kind of lead-in to just pay attention. Pay attention to the world around us.
Yeah. Indiscriminatory paying attention without judgment and seeing what is, we think we know a bit more than we do. So it's that humble essence of paying attention.
That's one of life's lessons.
Yeah.
Thank you, Scott. This has been an amazing conversation. We need to move on to the rest of the show. And let's hear that mystery sound again. Well, that was the drumming of a hairy woodpecker. Wendy Feltham recently photographed one pecking on an alder along the lower Big Quilcene Trail. The hairy woodpecker is slightly larger than its cousin and look-alike, the downy woodpecker. The drum is rapid and evenly paced, and it is a mode of communication, like a songbird song. And rather than an attempt to drill into the wood, which is actually, you sometimes observe woodpeckers drumming on metal, they're clearly not able to drill into it, either sex can drum, and they drum for several reasons. To establish and defend a territory, as a part of courtship, to solicit mating, to summon a mate, or in response to an intruder. So if you hear one this time of year, it's likely that the birds are reacting to the presence of a perceived threat. That could be you. Well, there's a lot happening in the next few weeks. We'll look forward about 2 weeks, since some of these events do require planning and or registration.
On Thursday, October 6th, the Jefferson Land Trust Natural History Society is hosting a presentation on the history and stewardship efforts of the Ho River Trust. The Ho River flows virtually intact for 56 miles from its source high in the Olympic Mountain Range down to the Olympic National Marine Sanctuary. The river corridor contains what many consider the world's richest old-growth and temperate rainforests. Check the Jefferson Land Trust website for details.
And for a very special experience, join the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society on Saturday, October the 8th, for an offshore field trip to the Swiftsure Banks west of Nea Bay. Expect opportunities to see alcids such as auklets and murres, shearwaters, storm petrels, jaegers, gulls, terns, and just maybe an albatross. Go to the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society website for details.
The fine folks at the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society are really active this fall. Also on October 8th, the Audubon Society is offering the first in a series of 10 classes in backyard birding. The first class will focus on fall landscaping for birds. Joel Holtrop, executive director for the Clallam Conservation District, will present important aspects of a bird-friendly yard, including food, water, and shelter, with emphasis on the use of plants native to this area. There will be an optional field trip, a 2-mile hike at the Dungeness Recreation Area. Find out more information on the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society website.
And on Wednesday, October the 12th, join the Northwest Straits Foundation, Washington State Parks, and the Jefferson County Marine Resources Committee at Old Fort Townsend State Park to celebrate the completion of the Nearshore Restoration Project.
On Friday, October 14th, take a visual journey into the imperiled world of endangered species. Join wildlife tracker, photographer, and author David Moskowitz for a presentation about the natural history of the mountain caribou of the Pacific Northwest and the challenges they face for survival in a changing landscape. Check the website on the Jefferson Land Trust for details.
And in line with our discussion topic today, on October 15th and 16th, spend 2 full days on the land with professional wildlife tracker David Moskowitz. The class offers an intensive training in the identification and interpretation of wildlife track and sign. The 2-day class is entirely field-based and will take place at different public and private protected natural areas. The size of the class is limited. To find out more or to register, visit the Jefferson Land Trust website.
The geology group at the Jefferson Land Trust hosts a talk on geologic nozzles during the afternoon of Saturday, October 15th. Dr. Sue Keffer will discuss how some fundamental concepts from aeronautics can explain commonalities between such phenomena as the eruptions of Old Faithful Geyser at Yellowstone National Park, the 1980 volcanic eruption of Mount St. Helens, and the rapids of the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon. Again, have a look at the Jefferson Land Trust website for more information.
So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas, or even if you think you might be interested in joining our fun team of Nature Now hosts. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Man Gave Names to All the Animals, a Bob Dylan song performed by Jason Mraz.
Man gave names to all the animals in the beginning, in the beginning. Man gave names to all the animals in the beginning, a long time ago. He saw an animal that liked to growl, big furry paws, and he liked to howl. Great big furry back and furry hair. I think I'll call it a bear. Man gave names to all the animals in the beginning, in the beginning. Man gave names to all the animals in the beginning, a long time ago. He saw an animal up on the hill, chewing up so much grass until she was filled. He saw milk coming out, but he didn't know how. He said, I think I'll call it a cow. Man gave names to all the animals in the beginning, in the beginning. Man gave names to all the animals in the beginning, a long time ago. He saw an animal that liked to snort, horns on his head and they weren't too short. And it looked like there was nothing that he couldn't pull. He said, I think I'll call it a bull. Man gave names to all the animals in the beginning, in the beginning. No, no, no. Man gave names to all the animals.